supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You might wonder why we're not doing a show about the massacre at Virginia Tech. And of course, given the nature of our show, we struggled with this all week. However, there's been a great deal of media coverage, some of it not very helpful at all. Understandably, our reactions have been impassioned as we search, sometimes desperately, for answers. Hundreds of families and children are in shock, as are many of us. In a few weeks, the shock will diminish and the underlying emotions will emerge. Any of us who've experienced a tragic loss know that when the initial crisis is over, we begin to feel the pain. And with it, inevitably, comes more questions. What happened? What does this mean? How can we live with it? We've decided to address these questions in an upcoming show, when we're more ready to tackle them. In the meantime, we've put together a web page with shows that may be helpful during this difficult time. You can find it by going to whyy.org. And now, on to today's show. You know, every year, close to 20 million Americans are affected by an extramarital affair. For many marriages, infidelity marks the end. But for some, it's a new beginning. Working through the aftermath of an affair can help couples confront their issues. It can even make marriages stronger in the long run. Today, we're joined by Dr. Janice Spring, a psychologist, family therapist, author of best-selling After the Affair, and her current book is called How Can I Forgive You? Janice, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-WHYY. We're talking about betrayal and trust in intimate relationships. Janice, you tell a story that I love in the opening of your book about how two fathers are watching two boys argue in a sandbox, and a few minutes later they're playing again. One father turns to the other and is amazed that they get over it so quickly, and the other says they chose happiness over righteousness. Is it really that simple in the long run?
Well, I then go on to say why I don't think that story pertains to what happens in forgiveness between thinking adults. It's a lovely story. It's a very inspiring story. People love the story. But forgiving somebody who has maliciously, willfully hurt you is a much more complicated process. And often people find current models of forgiveness to be rather simplistic and too charitable. This kind of, they see it as, you know, the onus of responsibility is often put on the hurt party, not on the offender to work to earn the forgiveness, but on the hurt party to forgive. Almost everything that's been written about forgiveness is written for the hurt party, about how they should let go, about how they, you know, will earn, that, you know, that it takes a good soul to forgive, and that they will be granted eternal life if they forgive, and that this is the decent thing to do, and that forgiveness is good for us, and we should and must forgive. It's fascinating how almost everything is written for the hurt party, with very little written to the offender. And so that kind of story, that it's sort of the righteous thing to do, again, is sort of fluffy and inspirational, but when it comes to forgiving, people struggle when it comes to real-life injuries.
Yeah, it sure does. We know theoretically it's a wonderful thing, and we know that it is healing, and all those things most people say are true, but it's you can't just sit down and say, okay, I'm going to do this for my own welfare. There's a lot more involved. Let's go to the beginning, Janice. When betrayal happens, I hate to use the word typically, but I will, typically, generally, what's the first response? First of the hurt partner and second of the unfaithful partner?
Well, I think it is helpful for hurt parties to, both parties, to realize that infidelity is a trauma and that people are doing badly not because they're trying to shame or punish their partner, but they are truly traumatized. And there are many psychological losses that take place in the hurt party. I document 10 of them, like the loss of the familiar self. This is where you might have thought of yourself as attractive and desirable and competent and funny and good company, and all of a sudden you've been knocked over and you can't recapture the way you're used to knowing yourself. So there's that loss of your familiar self, the way you want to be known.
And you also, one questions their judgment, too. What was wrong with me that I didn't see that coming?
Right. I see a lot. The loss of self-respect, that you didn't see the truth. And people often have very clear cues, and they're blind to it. And then they have trouble forgiving themselves because people will say, you know, my partner's working hard to rebuild, and I am working to forgive him, but how do I forgive myself? For 20 years, I knew this was going on, and I didn't say anything, and I didn't really even let myself see it. How do I forgive myself? So these are some of the losses, the loss of self-respect, the loss of familiar self, the loss of basic assumptions about how the world works.
And as I listen to you talking about these great losses and how exposed the person who's been betrayed is, how exposed they are to their own feelings and vulnerability, it really does make sense that to deal with those feelings, it turns to rage and judgment about others. I mean, that certainly feels, anger certainly feels better than all those other tender feelings.
Sure. Anger can be very, very organizing and very empowering at times.
Right.
And other people feel depression. You know, they just feel that they've been replaced or that they've been made a fool of, and they feel ashamed.
Well, what's the first reaction of the unfaithful?
The unfaithful partner?
Yeah.
Oh, it can vary, but sometimes people feel relief when it's out in the open because they've been leading a duplicitous life, and here's an opportunity. Sometimes they want the affair to be over. They want it to be out in the open. And often people don't necessarily want the affair. What they want is a better marriage, and they don't really know how to go about making that happen. So once it's out in the open, the marriage gets deconstructed, and maybe for the first time, the couple begins to talk about the real issues and why this happened, and that's constructive.
And that's the idea. Let me take a minute and reintroduce you, because I want to talk about the other side of what you just suggested. My guest is psychologist, family therapist Janice Spring. She's an expert on infidelity, on healing, and on, I guess, trust building.
Forgiveness, right?
Forgiveness, yeah. Her current book is called How Can I Forgive You? That's what we're talking about. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-WHYY. If you have had an affair, if you have been unfaithful, if you've been on the receiving end, at any level, we're not just talking about extramarital sexual affairs. Many people have been on the receiving end of betrayal, and many of us have been betrayers. Give us a call and tell us your story. So you talked, Janice, about couples who are able, after the affair, to deconstruct their marriage, but I know many people I've worked with, women especially, who said the only way they feel they can maintain their integrity is to leave the relationship. And this by women who truly love their husbands, but they say, how can I maintain my sense of self and stay here?
Right, right. Well, you know, first of all, let me say, people have a right to leave a relationship, and we don't have to be married. Our child is always our child, but our partner, our husband or wife, isn't always the husband or wife. So some people feel, look, you crossed the line. I will never trust you enough again, and I believe it's in my best interest to get out of this relationship. They have every right to do that, but I only ask that it be a thoughtful decision. Some people are very reactive, and they're thinking that they're a fool if they stay, or that there's no hope to rebuild. So they react out of injured pride, and that's really not healthy. So, in my model of forgiveness, you're not staying because you have a big heart. You're staying because the unfaithful partner is truly sorry and is able and willing to take responsibility for their share and is working hard to make you feel loved and cared for and to build trust and to make sure that it never happens again. So this is a joint effort. And I think people are less willing to forgive if they think it's something they've got to do themselves.
How does one reclaim trust in themselves?
Reclaim trust in the marriage? You mean
in themselves, in their own judgment. If your partner has betrayed you. I mean, we talked about all those things that happen, and one of them is you lose judgment. You lose trust in your judgment.
Right.
It's trust in self. How does that...
How do you know whether you're wise to trust or foolish?
To trust yourself, your own judgment.
Right, yes. Right. Well, you know, again, I don't think it's something that's done by the hurt party alone. I think that trust is an interpersonal process and that the offender is willing to do things that restore trust. I talk about low-cost trust-building behaviors and high-cost trust-building behaviors. And these are specific things that the offender is willing to do to make the hurt party feel safe. And they're very idiosyncratic. I mean, one person might say, call me several times during the day, just check in, tell me where you are, what's going on. Someone else will say, please don't call me several times during the day. So they're very individual. But, you know, some things commonly what people will say is that, tell me if the affair person contacts you in any way. Now, the offender may not want to do that. They may not want to say, look, I got an email today because things are going better, or they got a birthday card or a voice message. They may not want to reveal that because they're thinking, look, things are going better. Why stir up trouble? It's absolutely the wrong move, because when the offender becomes the informer, then the hurt party can give up their obsession. It's on their mind all the time. Mm-hmm. So even though it may, you know, stir up bad feelings in the moment, that is the way trust is built. It's not through verbal reassurances that, like, you know, trust me, you know, I'll never do this again, but through these concrete behaviors. So when the unfaithful partner says, look, I got an email today from Sarah. Here it is. I copied it for you to read. I did not respond back. And, you know, I'm an open book. You want to go into my computer, here is my password. You want to be sure that if I'm on the computer and you come up to me, I'm not going to turn off the screen. That's going to be a real trigger. But I'm going to give you permission to look. I'm going to give you access to my life. I am an open book. And I understand that even though I may not like this, it may make me feel a little suffocated and micromanaged. I understand that I did this to you, and that this is the way, one of the things I can do to help rebuild trust.
Let's go to the phones. I want to come later in the show to the other side of it, though, and that's the humanity of the perpetrator. I know you don't portray the perpetrator as two-dimensional either. There's a human back there with emotions, mm-hmm. also that have to be addressed. Let's first go to the phones. We've got Sally on the line. Sally, hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
My husband had an affair months ago, and about we've resolved things. He's changed. Our relationship now is stronger than it ever has been. But I can still find myself conjuring up and reliving some of these painful moments. Even, you know, looking back in hindsight, saying, that's why I was so upset back then, et cetera. And I know that those thoughts aren't serving me now, but I still can feel them. And I wonder, what's the most mature way to deal with those thoughts? Do I live through them? Do I experience them? Do I push them away, saying, this is not my life now?
Before we turn this over, I want to ask you, you said months, Sally?
Yeah, it was less than a year ago. It lasted 4 months, which I suppose in some people's standards is not that long. But it lasted 4 months, and it was revealed to me less than a year ago.
Okay, so let's turn to you, Janice. First of all, if she's saying less than a year, this seems pretty recent to me.
Right. I mean, that's the point to start at, that this is a trauma, I often say, is going to take at least a year and a half from the time when the offender gives up the affair and is perfectly honest. You know, no contact.
We're coming to like some anniversaries of some key moments.
Right, and you must absolutely get through those anniversaries, and they will be triggers for you.
Okay.
And he should also know that you'll be triggered. And I think the best is that, first of all, he doesn't assume that, you know, if you wanted to talk about you know, he should be sensitive to these anniversary dates and maybe spearhead time that he could, a different way of getting through those days, not necessarily celebrating, but where he is recognizing that this, how sensitive you are these days, he's open to talking with you, and perhaps you in return allow for something positive to happen on those days. So you begin to have a new memory on the day together.
And
you begin to have some healing tissue over the wound.
Mm-hmm.
You should not berate yourself for having flashbacks and traumatic memories. This is absolutely normal, and it's, you know, the mind has a memory, and that's one of the great things about our minds. So I think there, again, it's a two-person process. He has to be sensitive and not be impatient and be available to talk with you and invite you to talk openly about what you're struggling with.
I feel, if I might add one more thing, I feel reluctant to bring it up because he's obviously fine, or at least, you know, doesn't really talk about it much, probably wants us to move on as much as possible. So I feel like, being immature, am I not? I'm willing to move forward, but it's still in my head, you know?
Well, you're not the same person, and the affair impacted the two of you very differently. So it's in his interest to want to move on, because it just makes him feel bad to talk about it. But it's in your interest to make sure that everything that needs to be said is said, what the lessons that need to be learned are learned, and you're not going to be able to give it up as fast as he wants to. So that's the deal. I mean, each of you has to enter the deal. He has to be willing to talk about it with you and let you air your grievances and your insecurity and be there, and not impatiently, but be reassuring. And you have to also have times when you pack it up and you don't talk about the affair, and you allow for positive things to take place between the two of you.
Thank you. Thank you, Sally, for your call. I would also piggyback on top of what Janice said, that when you're having these thoughts, whether they're flashbacks or even obsessive thoughts, there are feelings attached to them. And those feelings are probably in the neighborhood of anxiety, vulnerability, hurt, tenderness. Those are the feelings that are attached to those thoughts. And when you're having those feelings, you need compassion. You need tender compassion, both from yourself and from your husband. You have to respect your feelings, let yourself feel them, and let them be there. Be compassionate with yourself, and then share them with your husband. My guess is he'll be open to caring for you in those ways. Sally, thanks for your call, and you brought up some very important things. We've got to take a short break now. My guest is Janice Spring. Her most recent book is called How Can I Forgive You? She's also the author of the bestseller After the Affair. And that's what we're talking about today on Voices. We're talking about betrayal, recovery, trust, and forgiveness, what it really means. Our number is 888-477-9499. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
The Depression Research Unit of the University of Pennsylvania Medical Center supports WHYY. Penn's DRU is conducting research into alternative herbal treatments of anxiety. Symptoms may include nervousness, tension, sleep problems, and concentration difficulty. Those who qualify will receive an initial evaluation and may take part in a research study with chamomile or black cohosh for up to 3 months. For details, 215-662-3462.
Bill Moyers has returned to PBS with new editions of Bill Moyers' Journal. The first episode is about the role of the press in the lead-up to the Iraq War. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Bill Moyers. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about infidelity and recovery. My guest is Dr. Janice Spring, psychologist, family therapist, and her most recent book is called How Can I Forgive You? You probably hate this question, Janice. I gotta ask it anyway. So,
which of the many? Whom you're
going to
ask. Go ahead.
You can almost predict it. So why do people have affairs? Is it always about a marital problem?
Damn, that wasn't the question that I thought I was going to hate the most.
Oh, tell me the one you would hate the most.
I'm not going to. So why do people have affairs? Is that the question?
Yes.
Okay. For many reasons, not one reason. The most important thing I want to say about this is people need to understand why they had the affair. And that answering that question, you know, is not a two-minute task. The couple needs to spend time, and the person who had the affair, probably it would be best if they spend time with a therapist,
so
uncovering what does it mean about me, what does it mean about you, what does it mean about our relationship, all the ways that all the contributing factors that went into why this happened, because those are the holes that need to be plugged. And without that understanding, there is no reason for the hurt party to trust that it won't happen again.
So that it is never simply because I am a bad person, or because you weren't sexual enough, or if she says to him, you were never there emotionally. It's never, I would imagine, almost never that simple.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, those kinds of simple responses aren't useful. They don't really then provide direction. What then? I mean, those may be contributing factors. Like, you know, you repeatedly refused me sexually. So, okay. So that's not the reason you had the affair, but that was a contributing factor. Now what happens from there is the person mismanages their resentment. You don't have to have an affair because somebody treats you badly. You can go to them and say, I am seriously unhappy in this relationship, and, you know, I need to either address this with you directly, or we need to get into therapy, or I want to get divorced, or I'm moving out. I mean, there are lots of things that you could do.
without destroying the person's trust. So it's never the reason why the person has the affair. The mismanagement of the anger then is more the reason why they had the affair, or getting even, or justifying in their own mind. So I say if you've had an affair, take 100% responsibility for it. Nobody makes you have an affair, like nobody makes you become an alcoholic or have an eating disorder. That's how you're mismanaging whatever you're experiencing. But I'll also say to the quote-unquote hurt party, you too have to take responsibility for how you contributed to your partner's unhappiness or dissatisfaction at home, how you helped make space between the two of you so that a third person came in between.
I read an article recently that suggested that in today's world, many affairs happen almost inadvertently as we spend more and more time at the workplace, and you know, what was a platonic relationship becomes romantic, and that piggybacks with a sociological article that was in the lay press, I think, last year, that suggested that the number of intimate relationships people have on the average has gone from 3 to 2 over the last 2 decades, and 25% of all respondents said they don't have an intimate relationship. So that's a potentially dangerous combination.
They don't have an intimate relationship with their partner, they're saying?
Period. In their lives, period. Uh-huh. And, you know, I'm not talking about sexual intimacy, just emotionally intimate, a confidant, I think, was the word they used. So, you know, we've got an increase of loneliness in today's world.
Mm-hmm. Well, people need to realize that friendship can quickly ignite into romance. And, you know, you're working closely with somebody, and that's all, you're confiding in them, and all of a sudden somebody crosses the line and says something personal, like, you know, I had a terrible fight with my wife or my husband this morning, or you know, thing lets them know that they're interested in the other person. And the chemistry gets ignited very fast, and people don't realize the power of romantic chemistry. So you've got the intimacy, the friendship that moves into a more intimate relationship very quickly. And then you've got the chemical backup that makes it very powerful and convincing.
And it really does take over the brain. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Bob on the line. Bob, hi, you're on Voices.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. The situation I have is that my wife and I had some ups and downs, you know, very complicated story, but we weren't intimate for a prolonged period of time, and you know, I did some exploring on the internet and did some searches, was just viewing things as, you know, candidly without the intention to seek a relationship, but I went on some personal sites and searched and things of that nature. This came to my wife's attention. So we're working through this, and, you know, she's obviously troubled that, you know, if I was in a chat room, I brought somebody into the third party into the relationship, and I'm really not trying to downplay this in the discussions with her, but for me it was very much, you know, this is kind of fantasizing. So we're trying to work through this gray zone. It's obviously not, it's not infidelity, but she views it as such, and I'm just interested in some advice on how to work through rebuilding trust, because the principal issue is less kind of looking at pornography. It's more that I had gone into some chat areas where there was, you know, a live person, and I viewed it as more or less interactive pornography, if you will. So maybe you could just share some thoughts relative to the somewhat gray zone of infidelity, but also, you know, how, you know, I'll get the book, but I need some further advice on how to rebuild trust.
Well, Janice, you first, and then I have some thoughts for Bob.
Okay. Well, first, I say that affairs often aren't about sex at all, but about secrets and the violation of trust. So the fact is you were being secretive, going online without her knowledge, chatting without her knowledge. So to me, this is an affair. It isn't necessarily about sex, And often people not only never touch these people, they never meet them in person. Now we have all this online, conversation. So that's one. The second is, I'd say, and the caller mentioned this, so I just want to reinforce it. When people begin to discount or minimize their behavior, what happens is the hurt party has to magnify it because they don't get it. Their partner doesn't get it. And what it does is it provokes them to then rage, and they're bringing out the very behavior they hate in them. So it's very important not to minimize, to step up to the plate and to mirror her and to say, I understand that I crossed a line, that this is unacceptable, and that even if it's not about sex, it's about secrets, it's about my having a closeness with someone over and above what I have with you. Because the person, there's a saying that Frank Pittman is famous for, it's not who you're lying with, it's who you're lying to. So if you're lying to your wife and the secret is with the girlfriend or this affair person, in a sense you have a closer relationship with that person than you do with your partner. And your partner is going to be very disturbed about this.
I would also suggest that even, Bob, if you want to minimize your behavior or minimize your motives, even if you want to do that, ethically, morally, you can't minimize the harm, the pain, the suffering it's caused your wife. That you have to acknowledge, that what you did caused her suffering. Even if you don't think it's a great crime, it did cause her suffering. The other thing I want to add to what Janice said is, you got online because you were hurting inside. And, you know, it's like Janice said earlier to an earlier caller, you were hurting inside and either you didn't know it or you didn't know how to manage it. And I would suggest to you that if you simply say, I'm sorry, I won't do it again, you're turning your back on your own suffering. And you need to know how you're hurting inside, what it means to you, and how to best care for that suffering. And that's something the two of you can work on together. Okay?
Thank you very much.
Sure, I wish you the best. I guess that's not such a gray area, internet dating or internet chat rooms. That's not such a gray area in your mind, Janice.
No, to me it's an affair. An affair is about secrets and the violation of trust. And so, people say it's not an affair. I don't know what the purpose of that is, really. In a sense, it's just a discounting the trauma and something's gone wrong. You know, they're turning, and these, by the way, people then do meet each other. All it takes is, you know, another few conversations, and often people do begin to meet each other. And it's very threatening to a partner to have the person have an intimate relationship that's secretive, that's beyond what they share with them. But as you were saying to this caller, I think it's a very important point, Dan, that you know, the grievances, the offender's grievances have to be addressed too. Something's gone wrong here, and hurt parties can't be so self-righteous that they see themselves as the only aggrieved victims. That often both people identify as the hurt parties. Both people have felt hurt in the relationship in some way. And there has to be, this is very hard often for hurt parties who want to only see themselves as the hurt ones. But often the other person has been hurt in some way too.
Hmm. You talk about secrets in the same way you talk about affairs. I treated a couple recently where it came out after 5 years of marriage that what she said about her childhood wasn't true, that she withheld some pretty significant secrets about her childhood. Psychologically, does that feel the same as any other kind of betrayal?
The husband felt betrayed that she didn't share her background with him.
Right.
I mean, yeah, that's another kind of betrayal, sure. And his, I mean, again, it, she may not have meant it for malicious reasons. She may, sometimes people feel that, you know, you'll judge me if you know my background. Or I don't want you to know that side of me because then you'll see that in me. She may not have meant it as a betrayal, but for him, it may have meant that she withheld information
So this is a case, Janice, that is probably addresses the issue that I wonder about more squarely. Here it is more visible, more obvious, that both people are suffering. If she has withheld, in this case it was a childhood trauma in her family, if she's withheld that from him, and you're right, she withheld it for fear of his judging her, his, you know, seeing her as less than.
Mm-hmm.
So now it comes out, he feels betrayed, and she feels incredibly vulnerable. Both their pain is right there. How's that get managed?
Yeah. Well, first of all, people have to take turns talking out their hurts. What I'll do is I'll often bring the two people tied together by the violation, and they each consider themselves the hurt party often, and they each probably have hurt the other person, offended the other person in some way. So one person starts and talks out their hurts, what it is that they want the other person to understand about how their behavior has hurt them. And then the listener mirrors, which is, a way of reflecting back, this is what you want me to understand, in a language so that the other person feels understood. And then I'll have them go home and write an apology letter that captures the specific ways in which they have hurt this person. And then they read it to them, they give them a copy of it. And then they reverse roles, and the other one does the same. So that's what I recommend, because each needs to be heard, and often people have this rapid fire back and forth. Yes, you know, you did this to me, but you did that to me, and one hand washes out the other. You can't, you know, make a point and listen to the other person at the same time.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Meredith on the line. Meredith, hi, you're on Voices.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you. I wanted to thank you for having this program. It's near and dear to my heart.
Well, I don't know if that's good news or bad news.
I think you're not alone, though.
Yeah, right. I know, exactly. It's a common. I know you're running briefly on time, so I just wanted to say I'm in a relationship. I should say I was in a relationship, which now we're no longer speaking. And when we ended it about a year and a half ago, I left him, and about a week later he had someone, a coworker, that was living with him then and was in a relationship. And he, when I tried to understand, and his explanation was that it was because of the enmity with my father, which was conditioned before we even got involved. And he said, I never did anything wrong. And I'm having trouble moving on because I just can't accept the plausibility of that explanation. I'm wondering if you could give me some feedback on that, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, here's an example, Janice, that Meredith brings up. You talk about the partnership, the role of the partnership in healing. And here, Meredith needs to heal and doesn't have a partner to do it with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, I think, you know, these are awfully brief examples, but I think I'm understanding that this man cut off a relationship because he hated her father.
That's apparently, she's not with us, but that's what I heard also.
Okay. Well, you know, my 2-minute response is, my first reaction is that, I don't know that these issues were talked out, and I got the sense from the caller that, that this person just sort of disappeared without anything being understood or resolved. So you're left alone, and to make sense of this, I don't know that people don't necessarily tell you the truth about what they leave, why they end a relationship, and often people don't know the truth themselves. They don't know how complex it is. So, in my mind, when you heal yourself and when the person is not sorry and does not care about your feelings, I say you are not required to forgive that person. I don't believe that forgiveness is good for you. I don't believe you're a better person if you forgive. I don't believe that forgiveness makes you better. What the research shows is that what makes us better is not forgiveness per se, but refusing to live in a grudge state.
Well, Webster defines forgiveness as letting go of resentment, letting go of the grudge. It's not about the other person. It's about letting go of the grudge. But how does one do that? I mean, you know, Meredith, you know, she's got these obsessive thoughts. How can she get beyond them?
Okay. And what I'm saying, Dan, is that I have developed two models, what I consider two healthy models. The forgiveness model is reserved for those offenders who have the courage and humility to step forward and make good. But when the person's not available for that, then I believe hurt parties have an obligation not to forgive, but to heal themselves. And I call that something else. I call that acceptance. And there are 10 steps to healing the self. And one of them has to do with learning not to dwell on the injury and not to be preoccupied. So people aren't willing to do that if they think it means forgiveness, because that seems too soft and fluffy. But when people understand, dwelling on the injury actually makes them sick, because the anger translates into stress hormones in the bloodstream that compromise our immune system and make us more susceptible to disease, and the buildup of plaque in the arteries that make us more coronary prone. We have an obligation to ourselves not to dwell about this injury, not to live in hate, and we do that for our own selves.
Well, for the matter of perspective, for Meredith's perspective, for everyone, certainly when you do this on your own, the work is harder, and it probably takes longer. So what's a time frame? What's a reasonable time frame?
I don't know that time heals. I think it has to be active intervention. And, you know, I talk about, you know, I have like 10 strategies for helping yourself let go of the resentment.
Do you think it can be done without intervention?
You mean without going to a therapist?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. I think people can learn this. I think if you have trouble, you go to a therapist. But gotcha. I think that, you know, there's thought stopping, which is a behavioral technique where you literally, as soon as you find yourself dwelling on the injury, you say stop and you try to redirect yourself. Because we could spend 20 minutes in a car easily, you know, just dwelling on something. It does us no good. It just stirs us up. And so it is the decision to actively intervene. But also, there may be a lot of self-blame and a lot of obsessive thinking about that. And I am not at all sure, and I won't say that because I know nothing about this case, that the truth is on the table here, that the full story is known. And so it would be a shame if this person beat herself up with simple responses over why this relationship broke up.
Well, Meredith, thank you so much for your call, and we do wish you the best. We're going to have to take a short break. My guest is Janice Spring. She's an expert on infidelity, on repairing marriages and relationships, on building trust and forgiveness. Her most recent book is called How Can I Forgive You? Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Penn supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit are providing evaluations to determine if you are suffering from depression. Symptoms may include mood swings, irritability, sleep disturbance, and lack of interest. Those who qualify may receive an initial examination and treatment with an investigational antidepressant for 3 to 12 months. For information, the DRU number at Penn is 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
Next time on Day to Day.
Try to picture this.
Author Richard Preston is taking in a view others can only dream of.
He can't see the ground below or the sky above.
He's in Northern California, nestled high in the branches of a majestic redwood tree.
You're in a lost world. You're in an undiscovered, unexplored ecosystem, somewhere between heaven and earth.
A 40-story climb to paradise.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with Dr. Janice Spring, psychologist and author of After the Affair, and her most recent book is How Can I Forgive You? Let's go right to the phones. We've got Sharon on the line.
Hi.
Hi, Sharon.
This is Sharon. I was calling to say that my husband and I actually reconciled after his affair 7 years ago, and I consider it sort of a poster child of reconciliation. We did all the things that your guest is talking about. I think we even bought her book. Within an hour of finding out about the affair, we were sitting in front of our priest and discussing it with him, and our road was always about staying together. We found a therapist that said, well, you may end up divorced, and that'll be okay, and we dropped her. We went to a new therapist who was whose goal was also to keep us together. And the affair happened because of circumstances for him as well as me. We both contributed to it, and we acknowledged that. And as I said, that was 7 years ago, and except for illness, I'm not sure that there was anything that could have really made us sit up and pay attention to the state of our marriage.
Yeah, poster child is the right phrase. Janice, I want to hear your reaction, but Sharon said a word that I wonder if this is the critical word. It's commitment. Commitment to... In Sharon's case, it was commitment to stay together. But I'm also wondering commitment to the process, commitment to work it through. I wonder if commitment is the issue about that affects prognosis. Sharon, thanks for your call.
Yes, thank you. Well, commitment by both people. So I think that is critical. I also hear both partners willing to look honestly at themselves and take responsibility for their share rather than blaming and pointing the finger. So that's a critical process of stepping up to the plate and being responsible.
Do you think,
I just want to say this other, Dan, that I have found that when one person presents themselves as so lily white and the other is so black, often that person has more trouble forgiving. And that process of being willing to take responsibility, whatever it is, it may only be 5% of the problem, but whatever it is, to also hear your partner's grievances is a critical process, of critical part of the forgiveness process.
Yeah, that business of righteous indignation, I compare it to... wearing a threadbare coat in winter, it really doesn't do you much good. And if that's what you feel all you have, it's not going to get you through the winter very well. And it often interferes with the healing process, that kind of righteous indignation, yes?
Absolutely. All it does is bring out defensiveness in both partners, which is the opposite process that has to take place.
Should all affairs get talked about?
Well, this is a question that's, often asked. And, even infidelity experts differ on their responses to this. Some people will say all the secrets have to come out, and only then do you really talk about why this affair happened. And other infidelity experts will say, don't reveal the affair, that the hurt party becomes obsessed with the affair and the couple never goes on to try to rebuild the relationship. It's just a selfish way of dumping your guilt. So it's very interesting. I would say that it's not necessarily necessary to tell the truth or not to tell the truth. I think what's important is that the offender understands why the affair happened and the couple addresses those factors that led to the affair.
Addresses the factors. I've treated a couple of people over the course of my career where they have had affairs, and in effect the affairs may have kept them in the marriage. It was about a spouse who was terribly depressed, and it was their way of hanging in there, another one who was physically ill temporarily, and you know, the affair was temporary until their partner got better, and then they were back in the marriage. It kept them in there.
Often people who have affairs will say they weren't having affairs because they wanted this person as their husband or wife. They didn't want to leave the relationship, and that person came along and met some need, but they never really loved this person. They weren't looking to replace their partner. They just weren't able. They didn't know how, or they weren't able to address the deficiencies in the marriage, which ultimately has to be done. And that's the positive side of affairs, that people go on. Something has gone wrong when an affair happens. Something is seriously wrong. People go on and address it head on. And if they can figure out why the affair happened and address those factors, they can go on to build something stronger than they had before.
And I love the final two things you said a couple of minutes ago, that what's required really is a commitment to the process and a willingness for both partners to really be open and take a look inside and share it with one another. Janice Spring, thank you so much for joining us.
Dan, thank you so much for having me on.
Janice Spring is a psychologist, family therapist. Her most recent book is called How Can I Forgive You? Join us next Monday, April 30th, when we'll be airing a special from a previous panel discussion held here at WHYY, and it's about the challenges adults with autism and their families face. Next Tuesday, April 1st, I'll be hosting two presentations at the Coexistence Festival in New Brunswick. Sorry, that's May 1st. It's the Coexistence Festival in New Brunswick, and the title of the presentations are called My Sister. It should be fascinating. Look up more information about that at my website, drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show's been Bob Purdick. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.
Day to day is